Okay. All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to your June 20th Committee on Rules. We have a very busy agenda. We're going to basically work till we drop and try and get most of these bills done today. As most of you can tell, we don't have a quorum yet. I anticipate we will get one, but Senator Ringo is out for the afternoon, so we're down shorthanded, and we may need to call in Senator Courtney. The first hearing we're going to do is 3179. House Bill 3179 was the reschedule from last week. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3179 modifies the laws governing registration of athlete agents by incorporating provisions of the Uniform Athlete Agents Act.
So here the room is just all different but the same.
Yes.
Carl
Bier.
Hello.
Hello, this is Kate Brown. How are you?
Oh, yes, Jermaine Brown. I'm very well. Thank you for calling.
Good. We don't have any committee members here yet, but we'd like to go ahead and proceed in subcommittee for the record.
Right.
Please be aware that you are being heard throughout the building, and this is being recorded for posterity.
Okay.
Could you tell us a little bit about the bill?
Absolutely, and thank you for accommodating me in this way.
And I'm sorry about last week.
Oh, don't mention it. I know you're very busy at the end of this legislative session, and I'm happy to be flexible. The bill is briefly, and I'll try to keep it short unless you have particular questions. Is an improvement or a refinement of existing law. Oregon has, for several years, has had oversight of athletic agents that represent students, and the reason is there's potential for harm to students and to their educational institutions if the student athletes sign up for professional status while they're still playing for schools. It can lead to ruining of the careers of the students, and it can also lead to substantial penalties for the educational institutions. So what Oregon has always done, along with most of the rest of the states, is impose certain conduct requirements on the agents, certain requirements of notification to the educational institution once the student does take professional status. This bill in particular would enhance some of the powers that the Oregon Department of Education has for enforcement of these regulations. For example, it would add subpoena power so that the Department of Education could get the records it needs for investigations. It allows for administrative fines rather than just criminal penalties and revocations of licenses and so on if there is misconduct. And it also streamlines the application process for agents that want to legitimately do business with Oregon students. This is a version of something known as the Uniform Athlete Agents Act, and the fact that it's a uniform act signals that it comes from the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, which I am a member of.
That was going to be my first question.
Yes, about the conference?
Yes. And how long have you been a member of the conference?
I think it's been about 3.5 years now.
Okay.
The other members are Joe Willis from Schwabe, Williamson & Wyatt, and Martha Walters here in Eugene.
I know Ms. Walters because I serve on the Oregon Law Commission with her.
Oh,
it's
good.
Been very helpful to have her both serve on both of those
bodies. Yes, yeah, she's terrific. As you know, then, the National Conference is devoted to harmonizing the laws of the various states in areas where, for economic reasons or other sort of national reasons, we want to allow business to be transacted sort of frictionlessly across state borders. And the idea here with this act is that since so many states do have regulations in this area, and since it's desirable to have the legitimate agents reaching into Oregon or into various states and not just being limited to one jurisdiction, the idea is to have the application procedures be similar from state to state.
Do you have a sense of how many student athletes might be affected on an annual basis by this bill?
In Oregon, I can only speak to secondhand information that I got from Deborah Lincoln at the Department of Education. By the way, is she there by any chance for the hearing?
Yes.
Okay.
She is.
I should probably just defer to her and Deborah. You'll forgive me if I'm completely misremembering, but if I recall, I think you said it was something like 20 or 30 agents that you currently had registered in Oregon. But I should really defer to Deborah.
Hang on just a minute. We're going to bring her up to the...
Okay.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, Deborah Lincoln from the Department of Education. There have been, to answer that question, 29 athlete agents. There are currently 19 that are current.
Okay. And Ms. Lincoln, since you're here, is the department all right or okay with the souped-up enforcement provisions in the bill?
Yes, Professor Briere and I have worked a little bit in the conjunction on this, and we have gotten some issues worked out. The question about moral turpitude, our statute before that was a little more specific, but I think we've gotten those issues worked out with the amendments, and it was also the department's recommendation that the renewal fee be dropped to $150, and I believe we've taken care of that. It will cause us to create a little bit different form than we are currently using, but I think that we can accommodate that.
Thank you, Ms. Lincoln. Any questions for Ms. Lincoln or Professor Bier? Actually, that would be good. We have the Dash 1 amendments. Is that something both the department and Professor Bier that the uniform folks are okay with?
Speaking on behalf of the department, yes, I believe so.
Professor Bier?
Yes, yes, Chair Brown.
Ms. Lincoln, could you kind of walk us through this amendment?
It would probably be more appropriate for Professor Bier to do that. I think he worked more in detail if he's got them.
Do you have the amendments in front of you, Professor?
Yes, I do.
Could you walk us through them, please?
Certainly. As you can see, most of them are matters of cross-reference and so on. The thrust of them is to preserve the ability that's always been in Oregon law for the Department of Education to conduct criminal background checks on agents that are applying. Mostly through oversight, the original bill was going to delete ORS 702.022, and you see that in line 2 of the amendments. This is probably the most important part of the amendment. We are deleting the reference to 702.022. In other words, what that does is remove what would have been the repeal. And that's the section that allows the background checks to be made. The other sections, I believe, are most, well, let's see, on line 12, this is something that Ms. Lincoln brought up, the fee for renewals of licenses. We thought $150 was a more appropriate fee than $250. And then let's see. Oh, starting on line 15, I guess it's a very light redraft of that same section about criminal background checks. It's simply changing the terminology to conform to what's in the new proposed bill, a certificate of registration rather than a permit, and so on.
Thank you. It looks like pretty standard language of all the fingerprinting bills that we've passed out of this committee. So, any further questions? Thank you very much. We really appreciate your willingness to join us this afternoon.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for accommodating me on this basis, and I do hope you'll be able to move the bill and the amendments to the full Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Licken. We really appreciate your time. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3179. Let's go to the top of the agenda, public hearing on House Bill 2236.
Why did you get kicked out of our room, madam?
I assume it's the timing issue. Senator Atkinson is extremely concerned that we're in a different room than normal.
Got me all
messed
up.
Everything seemed backwards. I think it's because we're meeting all afternoon, and I don't know what happened. House Bill 2236.
Yeah. Facing east versus west, it's a big problem.
Okay, I'm sorry. All right. Okay. All right. Well, I'm sorry. Sorry, Representative Esquivel, I did not see you in the room. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2772. Representative Esquivel, why don't you come on forward? Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill? You fit in with all the other folks. I didn't see you. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 2772 allows insurance carriers to offer health benefit plans to 500 or more members of a guaranteed association, which has a statutory definition that I'm sure we'll hear about. It also modifies other provisions of the law governing to those types of health benefit plans.
Thank you. Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. I'm here to testify and give you some background of why this came about. 15 years ago, however long it's been, I became a realtor and found out that we were called independent contractors, which is our choosing. But the unfortunate thing is that the insurance industry had kind of a way of where we were unable to get a group health policy through our association and or through a large group. So consequently, we have no way a vehicle to do that other than individual basis. So therefore, I initiated this and reworded the law actually to comply, so we have the availability through the Oregon Association of Realtors the ability to have a group health policy stated to us by the carriers, and this may impact as many as 30,000 people. There's 15,000 realtors, approximately 15,000, and their spouse, it would be 28,000 approximately, plus their children and the people that work for the real estate firms. So this will have a great impact to bring some affordable health insurance to a group that has yet to have that in the past due to the fact that they are independent contractors.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Yes. Do you have strong feelings? My understanding is the agreement worked out, or at least the agreement worked out between the insurance industry and the Realtors Association, that left out the issue of 500 to 1,000. Where are you on that particular issue?
Our original agreement was 500, and that's what we've stayed with.
Okay.
And I believe that the appendage has 500, I believe.
Okay.
Does it not?
All right. Any other questions for Representative Esquivel?
Good bill.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Next up, Ms. Jarvis, and I'm sorry, W.S. Woody Outerkirk.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, Jana Jarvis, representing the 15,000 plus members of the Oregon Association of Realtors. We keep growing this legislative session, so we have toppled 15,000 members in the recent month. We brought House Bill 2772 forward to you today because of exactly what Representative Esquivel mentioned. We have been unable previously as an association to band together to provide group health insurance as a member benefit. The reason largely was because our members are independent contractors, and then we were unable to combine them with employees of the association and employees of the firm. So the Dash 7 amendments that you have before you today redefine us as a guaranteed association inclusive of employees of the associations and the firms as well as the independent contractors. In addition, those Dash 7 amendments speak to two or three other things that are a result of continuing the work group discussions that we had on the House side. I think it's important to note for you that nationally in 1996, there were 13% of our members that didn't have health insurance, but by 2004, this number had risen to 28%. So while Representative Esquivel mentioned to you that we have these members who are looking forward to this plan, it speaks largely to the fact that nearly a quarter of our members likely are not already insured. In addition to that, the Dash 7 amendments speaks to the open enrollment period, which was a concern to some of the insurer groups, as well as the size of the group. And you asked the question about the 500 or the 1,000. We have been back and forth on this, but we have all agreed on the 500 as the minimum number, although I expect that we will put together a really terrific plan and that will be a moot point in a few months. So with that, I'd like to introduce you to Woody Outerkirk, who is one of our members. He has a kind of a story to tell with respect to the reason for the need for this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Jarvis.
Thank you, Senator Brown. For the record, I'm W.S. Woody Outerkirk, owner, broker, Mishy Real Estate, M-I-S-H-E-Y, in Newport, Oregon. It's a small one-person office right now. I'm looking for an associate if somebody wants to go into the real estate business.
Several legislators looking for work, so we'll send you the resumes.
Thank you. My story kind of is in support of this bill. I've been in the real estate business for roughly 17 to 18 years. My wife worked for the Lincoln County School District in the interim, and for the first 12 years of my business career, I enjoyed her insurance policy through the Lincoln County School District and their negotiations on group rates. As she approached retirement, I began looking around to replace the policy that she had through Blue Cross Blue Shield. And I virtually couldn't find anybody that would take me and give me the policy that she had. There was just nothing out there that I could find. The closest I could come would have cost me somewhere between $900 and $1,200 a month. And I would have had to limit some of the services that I was receiving through the Blue Cross Blue Shield and her employment. After she retired, we were able to go into the COBRA extension of the Blue Cross Blue Shield, and we contributed right at $800 a month for the policy extension on her Blue Cross Blue Shield. I continued to look for policies or opportunities for insurance, and I could find none that would take me as an individual. We finally settled with, I believe it's Fortis. We've taken a $5,000 deductible policy. We've done away with our dental coverage. We've done away with our vision coverage. My wife and I are in good health. We don't have any medical history or any, and we don't do prescription drugs. We just never have taken advantage of that. In spite of all of those things, and because of the deductions, I've managed to obtain a policy right now that runs at about $450 a month for myself and my wife. We pay everything up front. All of our normal visits and stuff like that are all paid in front. So we're virtually not taking advantage of anything on that policy because of the deductions and stuff like that. So I hope that you can make some sort of effort to pass this bill so that we can at least be approached or approach the insurance companies for some sort of a group rate.
Mr. Outerkirk, the real estate business in Newport doing fairly well?
In the last year, it's done great.
Because California is moving north, right?
They're looking at a lot of cheap ground up there.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us today. Next up, Mr. John Powell.
Mm-hmm. you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Madam Chair and members, first of all, I would just say that Mr. Outerkirk did not fill you in on all of his history. His dad was in the state senate when I arrived in 1975, and a true gentleman and spirited Oregonian. So I just wanted to finish the record on his testimony.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
House Bill 2772 is before you today in a far different form than it was introduced, and we owe that to a long negotiation period between the realtors and the insurance industry. And I want to thank the association for working with the industry over this long 5.5 month period. The issue that was brought up is the only sticking point in the bill, and I say sticking point in that we have agreed to at least be neutral or say pass this bill. But the number 500, in my opinion, is the same as the number 1,000. When you have a group of 15,000 people, if you only gather 500 of those together for the purposes of group health insurance, you're likely going to be adversely selected against, and thus the group will not become a group that will be sustained over time. And if in a normal place of employment of, let's say, 100 employees, the reason that group health insurance works is that under normal circumstances, most if not all of those employees are covered under the health plan. So you have 75% to 100% of those employees covered. Your chances of being adversely selected against in a situation like that would be limited to those who get a job at that work site solely for the purpose of getting health insurance. Now that happens, but it doesn't happen a whole lot. In a group of 15,000 people, and you have just a small subset of those people electing toward this product, it is likely that they would be people who like the rich benefit of the plan or the low cost of the plan. It's not going to draw people who have a policy like Mr. Outerkirk explained, with vision, dental, everything you can think of, paid for by another employer. They're not likely to come into that group unless they're working with an employer that has a very skinny plan and they're high users of health care. They will then search for a plan, even if it costs a little bit more, because it provides so much more in terms of benefits. So the issue of 500, I think Jana is correct, is going to become moot eventually, because unless they can garner a good mass of individuals from the potential of this group of 15,000, then it's probably just not going to work over time. And so, again, we appreciate their willingness to negotiate on all of the various aspects of the bill, and I would answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. Senator Shields.
You said it won't work over time. I just want to understand why it won't work over time.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Shields, a health plan where people can choose to either be a part of it or not, as this one will be, which is different than most group insurance. If Blue Cross, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, is going to insure a business, they would have a limitation on participation. They would require 75% or more of those people to participate. And again, the reason is so that their plan does not become
a high risk
yeah, pool, if you will, of people who just seek it for the rich benefits or the cost. And so in that regard, and the association understands this, we've had long discussions with them, and they understand the need to get that number as high as possible in terms of making it sustainable over time. And again, if your health plan suffers from adverse selection, you have to raise your rates in order to cover those payouts. As you continue to do that, more and more of the healthy people leave because they'll find some other mechanism to get insurance from, leaving only those who are using it every day or every year. And the result of that then is a death spiral of the plan.
Yeah, that's what you meant when you said adversely selected.
Yes, it is. But again, I can't emphasize enough how much we appreciate the association working with us on this bill.
Mr. Powell, isn't it also possible that sort of the what I hear you saying is that instead of cherry picking, it could be work as a high risk pool, that you know folks who can't get health insurance elsewhere will come here. But Mr. Outokirk just testified. I mean, you know, we didn't go into depth in his health history, but obviously there is a group of realtors out there that are in good health that haven't been able to get competitive plans elsewhere. Isn't it possible that this draws those folks as well, and that what you really need is a critical mass of both?
Madam Chair, it's going to have to draw those people.
Okay.
If it's going to be functional. It will simply have to.
Okay.
Senator Shields. This is maybe a rhetorical question, but there's no sense of what percentage you might be able to pull.
Ms. Jarvis, why don't you come on up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Shields, for the record, Jana Jarvis. We have done some informal survey, which is not statistically valid, at a number of our meetings over the last year or different groups. We've asked our membership to indicate to us who would be interested in a health insurance policy. And I can attest to you that at least two-thirds, if not three-quarters of the audience at our spring convention raised their hands. So I think there's a very high interest in the product. And Mr. Powell is exactly right. We need to be able to offer a good competitive product. And obviously the wider the pool, the more competitive our product will be. So we have the same goal in mind.
It's a hopeful sign, in other words.
All right. Ms. Jarvis, I guess, and then my other question is, I mean, I don't know a lot of realtors. We don't buy and sell property a whole lot, so I don't know a lot. But my sense of the folks in the industry, that something that's portable, i.e. from one association to another to on their own, might be extremely useful for folks in that particular industry. Are there differences in terms of folks moving from job to job?
Excuse me, Madam Chair, are you asking me if people move from firm to firm, real estate
firm? Or
yes, they do that. And so having their health benefit through the association would be more advantageous to them because it would provide consistency. And we did put some sidebars on the open enrollment period and on going in and out of the program to encourage more full-time participation from our membership as well.
Thank you. I don't know if realtors are different than I was thinking of lawyers going from firm to firm, but I don't know that lawyers move firms as frequently as realtors do. I just don't have a sense of that.
I would suspect they move more less frequently. I suspect our members move more frequently.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you both very much. Appreciate your hard work on this issue. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2772? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2772. Any legislators in the room? Anybody got legislators on their bill? We want to come move up the list a little bit. Let's go to back up to House Bill 2236. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2236. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill? And you already brought me a sign-up sheet, right? It's in my pile somewhere.
Thanks, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 2236A requires the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to adopt rules governing the leasing rates charged by state agencies that rent or lease facilities to other state agencies.
Who's the sponsor of the bill?
It's the sponsor of the bill. I can tell you in 1 second.
Is there anybody in the audience signed up for this particular bill? Is there anybody wishing to testify on this particular bill? This has not happened before. Okay. All right. Well, that makes that public hearing really quick. All right. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2236. If someone in the audience or further out hears that we heard this bill and is interested in us moving it, you should probably let us know. House Bill 2315. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2315.
Madam Chair, Committee, House Bill 2315A expands the scope of individuals who are designated for protection and advocacy by the Oregon Advocacy Center. And the Oregon Advocacy Center is the protection agency for individuals with disabilities.
Okay, I've got Mr. Stan Cerniak and Ms. Kathleen Wilds. Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Brown and members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Wild. I'm the legal director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. The Oregon Advocacy Center was founded in 1977. It was designated by Governor Straub to be Oregon's protection and advocacy system. It receives federal funds for the specific purpose of advocating on behalf of people with disabilities. Among the authorities that come with that funding are authority to access facilities that care for people and also access the records of individuals who we have reason to be concerned about in terms of their rights or safeties if there's no guardian available. Since its founding, OAC has been referenced in state law along with its authorities, and since the time that that bill was written and since the founding of OAC, the federal government has expanded the population. It's no longer just people with developmental disabilities, but also those with mental illness, physical impairments, traumatic brain injury. So under federal law, our P&A access authority and our authority to get records has been expanded to those populations. This bill does two things. One, there are various places in statute where OAC is referenced, never consistently. And so what the bill is doing is cleaning up those references so that there's no question as to when you're referring to OAC. The other thing it does is to make state law relatively consistent with federal law in terms of our access authority. We've taken into account the concerns of the Department of Corrections and the Oregon Youth Authority on our access authorities in reaching this agreement. It pertains to all individuals with disabilities outside DOC and OIA, and within those facilities, only if the disability is substance abuse are they excluded from protection. So as I said, we've worked closely with DOC and OIA. We have access agreements with them. And the reason we need this bill is to both clarify and also because it's much easier for people to look to state law when they're questioning our access authority. It's much more familiar to them. They're much more comfortable with it. The legislation currently reflects part of our authority. This is just broadening it to reflect the rest of our authority. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Sir.
Chair Brown and members of the Senate Rules Committee, good afternoon. My name is Stan Zerniak. I'm the Assistant Director for Operations for the Oregon Department of Corrections. We in the Department of Corrections, I'm here to talk in favor of this bill. We in the Department of Corrections recognize that the Oregon Advocacy Center has a legitimate and valued role in advocating for the rights of persons with mental disabilities. And these do include those that are in custody with the Department of Corrections, which incidentally today consists of about 24% of our population, our inmate population. We also recognize that the rights of this group stem from the federal government and that the assistance that they provide to potentially vulnerable populations is indeed valuable. The OAC has been active in Oregon for 15 years, but only recently began to cover the work of inmates, and I'd say this has been within about the last two and a half years. The department has, during that period of time, established a very good working relationship with the center, particularly with Director Bob Jundep. And furthering that relationship, we are nearing completion of a memorandum of understanding that will clearly define the rights and responsibilities of both partners. This agreement will guarantee the center access to Department of Corrections facilities while also ensuring prison security and safety and other concerns of that type. We worked very closely with Bob Jundep on this bill, and he was very responsive. to our concerns about possible unforeseen consequences of some of the original bill's provisions. Working with Mr. Junedep, we reached agreement on amendments that became the current A-engrossed versions of this bill. We look forward to an ongoing partnership with the Oregon Advocacy Center and respectfully request that you send out House Bill 2315A with a due pass recommendation. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Questions? Looks like you're off the hook this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2315? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2315. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2729. Representative Burley, Senator Westland, why don't you guys come forward? Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, House Bill 2729A authorizes cities and counties to create community forest authorities. The bill also authorizes community forest authorities to issue revenue bonds to finance forest lands.
All right. As for legislators, and they come crawling out of the woodwork. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54. House Bill 2729A does authorize municipalities to set up community forest authorities. And I think another person that's signed up to speak here today can go into some of those details if you wish. But I think what's important here is to understand the genesis of this idea. We've seen recently with the changes in some forest products ownership, specifically one company bankrupt, another one changing ownership, a great deal of commercial forest lands in eastern Oregon and elsewhere throughout the state. The future of these blocks of timberland is uncertain. And what this bill would allow is it takes the same concept, the same ideas that are already in statute for a hospital authority, where you have a stated public purpose, the authority's created, issues revenue bonds, not general obligation bonds, and a private nonprofit corporation could then use those revenue bonds to acquire this type of an asset that is a large contiguous block of working forest land. And the purpose is to keep this in a working forest condition to provide the multitude of public benefits as well as commodity products. And in fact, it's the management of those lands that has to occur in order to generate the revenue to pay off the revenue bonds. And what's really important to understand is that these lands are not publicly owned. They're owned by this private nonprofit corporation. And the debt is solely the responsibility of the private nonprofit corporation. In other words, the municipality that sets up the authority does not assume any of the debt. They're not general obligation bonds. So again, if you think about how a hospital authority works, in this case, it's just a different asset that's being acquired or constructed. In the case of a hospital, you construct a hospital. In this case, you're acquiring and operating commercial forest lands.
All right. Sarah Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Westland, District 27, I want to compliment Representative Burley for bringing this bill forward. I think it's not only a good bill, I think this is a great bill. And it's an approach that I think is long overdue at helping us to look at the management and stewardship of our forest lands. It's innovative in that it seeks to keep large blocks of forest land in working forest condition. Key point, this bill is not mandatory for anyone. It simply provides for that municipalities have one more option to prohibit large blocks of timberland from subdividing into smaller, more developable parcels. And as we can all imagine, once we lose those blocks of timberland, we can't get them back. The intent of this bill is to provide commodity products as well as to maintain the resource values we prize, such as fish, wildlife habitat, clean water, and public access for multiple uses. This bill is modeled, as Representative Burley has said, after the Hospital Financing Authority, which provides an opportunity for local ownership and local control without any municipality owning the property or assuming any of the debt. A key component of this bill is that no taxpayer dollars are at risk. This bill is broadly supported by members from industry, community and conservation groups, and sustainable management, sustainable management forest land partnerships. Under this concept, the forest would be managed to provide revenue to pay for operating expenses, debt, and taxes. Any excess revenue would go to the local community for roads and schools. This is an excellent, excellent bill. It's one of those that comes along not often enough. Again, I'd like to compliment Representative Burley for his creative, innovative, and forethought in bringing such a concept before you. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Sir Atkinson.
Thank you. I know Senator Beyer had had some amendment. I've only heard about it, about forcing writing in there that it has to be harvest. There will be harvest quotas. And I know there was also some question when Representative, when you and I spoke about it, about how would this be enforced. You originally used the example of a hospital. Bonds for a hospital, and if you don't build a hospital but you build an office park, certainly those bonds and the builder of the hospital is now in jeopardy for prosecution. But who would really prosecute this if it wasn't managed like a forest should be managed under your vision?
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, the question is, how can we be assured under this concept that the lands would actually be managed for commercial forest land use? Which is a very good question, and we actually amended the bill in the House to strengthen and make even more clear that the purpose of doing this is just that, for the permanent management for commercial forest land uses. Though we didn't put the word harvest in there, I believe it's clear when you look at the definition, commercial forest land use, that's the purpose of doing it. We also strengthened in the House through amendment what we did was we made it very clear that it's the private nonprofit corporation that would actually acquire and operate the asset. Now, they could either operate or to contract that out, but it's the private nonprofit that would actually acquire the asset. In other words, it's not the authority, it's not the county, it's not a city or a municipality, but the private nonprofit under this concept that would actually acquire the land. With respect to the bonds, what we did after we had that meeting with you was we went back to our bond counsel that had been working with us on this, a Mr. Doug Goh, with Eric Harrington and Sutcliffe, and I do have a copy, which I believe I've made available to someone. I could leave this for the record if you wish. From him that talks about the enforcement mechanisms related to forest authorities. And in the interest of saving you some time, and I'm not going to read this and I'm not the bonding counsel, but I will submit this for the record because it goes through here and talks about the different types of enforcement mechanisms, the bond trustee, the insurance companies, the forest authority itself. You've got SEC regulations that have to be complied with.
So,
Sir Atkinson.
What you're telling me, thank you very much. What you're telling me is there is, if it's not managed, as you've decided, as is outlined under, for lack of a better term, generally accepted forest management principles, there is a chance of defaulting on the bond through the SEC?
Yes, it could be through any number of means. Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, that's correct. First of all, the bond, the whole deal would have to be set up with qualified opinions, or unqualified opinions from bonding counsel that says, you know, this is the way the package is put together. These are bona fide parties. They've got the financial capabilities to do it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
So what you're really saying is there's significant stage fright to setting one of these things up for frivolous or non-means of management.
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, if I had the desire to use this authority to buy a large block of land and turn it into a park, I can assure you I would not take the time and the cost to use this authority. I would go out and get the money and just buy it separately.
Another question. That's because the fiduciary responsibility under the SEC is to the individual, not necessarily the corporation. Is that right?
I am not qualified to answer that question.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could address that issue. I know Senator Beyer has asked some questions regarding, well, is this ground ever going to be harvested? I think the simple answer to that question is that this bill is widely supported by the forest products industry. They're not doing this to create more parks. And as Representative Burley has previously indicated, there will be no bonds issued. There could be no properties acquired if there wasn't a forest management plan that included sustainable yield off these properties. I think more legislators should ask more questions more often, but I don't think this is a question that needs to be dwelt on any longer.
So, Madam Chair?
Sarah Atkinson.
Are you saying, good senator from Sisters, that I don't ask enough pointed questions? Is that what you're asking? Would you ask me to ask you more pointed questions on this and other matters?
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, as I indicated, I would like more legislators to ask more questions more often, but on this question, I don't think there needs to be further inquiry.
Madam Chair.
We do think, Senator Atkinson, you should be wearing a stronger spiff on the weekends, but that's another matter.
Thank you.
Yes?
I don't think that the good senator from the Sisters region answered my question. Perhaps you would like some more questions on the floor, because under our rules in the Senate, it doesn't have to be germane to a bill. I can just ask you a question anytime.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson, but the chair won't let you this afternoon because
no,
we have a number
on the floor
of bills.
Tomorrow.
That's fine.
All right.
May I ask what a spiff is, Madam Chair?
Sun protection factor.
Oh, I knew that.
All right. Any further questions?
She's
Senator
very
Field.
Mother finished to me.
Thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2729 for the time being. I need to bring up Representative John. Yeah, that's right. I was going to say Rocky, but that's your son. Representative Dalm, why don't you come on up? Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill? 2831. Sorry.
Thanks, Madam Chair. House Bill 2831A allows municipal courts to assign judgments in criminal actions to the Department of Revenue.
All right. Representative Dalm.
Thank you very much, Chair Brown, and the Senate Rules Committee for hearing House Bill 2831. I have with me Gene Parker from the City of the Dalles. He has followed the bill very closely. He and I have worked
on it. Can I bring up Ms. Munson as well? Is she still interested in testifying?
I ask her, and she will be available if you have questions.
Okay.
I have several others that are available. In fact, if the committee has any questions, whether they come from Senator Atkinson or anyone, we will find people to answer.
Ms. Munson is now, but do you want Douche to join us? Okay. Why don't we wait and see if there are questions, and then we'll bring more people up.
I think we can do this rather quickly. The House Bill 2831 came out of the House Committee 90 and off the House floor 5901. I would recommend the passage of this bill. Basically, the Department of Revenue has said that the process of collecting fines will, because of the streamlining of their process, will not be a problem for them. The League of Cities has agreed that this bill serves the needs of their members. The Oregon Collection Association, who sat in on a work session with us, agrees that the tenets of this bill can be supported by their organization. And I know of no opposition to this bill at this time.
That's always good, Representative Dalm.
And if you come up with any, I'll find somebody to answer it.
Okay.
And in the meantime, I think you've got a brief explanation and you know who supports it.
All right. Mr. Parker.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. I'm the city attorney for the City of the Dalles. This process was initiated at our request to basically give us another tool to handle problems with collections of criminal actions in our municipal court.
Okay. Oh.
In July of 1998, the court entered an order writing off approximately over $1 million in outstanding judgments, which were deemed uncollectible by the court. We've been working with the local collections agency to try to collect that sum. And as of March, we had over 6,000 cases that were with the collection agency and a balance owed to us in excess of $1.2 million. So we're talking about a significant sum that we're trying to collect. We have revised our court policy to toughen up that policy. We've established a process to notify people who miss payments, and in cases where a traffic violation is involved or an infraction, we will suspend licenses if the fines aren't paid. We have a contempt process we can use to bring people back in if they don't make payments. And we do work with local collection agencies where we've lost contact with defendants who don't pay the amounts. Again, this is just a bill we're asking to give us an additional tool to collect these outstanding judgments. And I would add that part of the money that's owed to us includes assessments that is also owed to the state of Oregon. So if we're successful in collecting these amounts, we would actually collect money for the state also, too. So we're encouraging the committee to recommend this bill be passed.
Questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us. Ms. Munson doesn't wish to testify, but she gives the bill a one thumb or two thumbs up? Two thumbs up. Okay. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2831? Thank you very much for a closed public hearing on House Bill 2831. Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2596. I guess I should have gone down to 2729. Oh, well.
Do I yell aye now or
no? No. We'll tell you when you can.
I yell no or aye?
No. You can I'll tell you when you can yell.
Okay. Madam Chair, Committee, House Bill 2596A authorizes the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs to adopt rules designating classes of board licensees that can perform certain functions relating to different types of non-complex electrical installations.
All right. Anybody wishing to testify on House Bill 2596? All right. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2596. Reopen the public hearing on 2729. Mr. Tuckman, Mr. Kludig, anybody else wishing to testify on 2729?
Those daughters. Those your daughters?
Yeah.
It is not take your daughters to work day, but my guess is his daycare options were limited, right?
That's part of it, and there wasn't able to take him down here for a hearing on Take Your Daughters to Work Day, so we're okay. Making up for it today.
And what are their names?
Their names are Helen and Emmy.
And where do they go to school?
They go to Ainsworth.
Okay, lucky them.
Do they sit up here while they watch their dad?
No, they're fine back there.
All right.
Thank you, Senator.
All right.
Bill, go ahead.
Chair Brown, Committee, for the record, my name is Bill Kluding, Western Council Industrial Workers. House Bill 2729 is a good bill. It ensures that a large forest is kept intact and become and will remain a sustainable yield working forest. It's very important to keep these intact large forest grounds. One thing is going to keep it open for recreation. This is the center of this state, one of the most used areas in our state as far as recreation. Secondly, it is the wintering grounds for our prime mule deer herd that exists in Central Oregon. It winters in this area. And we can create a handful of steady, dependable jobs out of this forest. And once the bonds are paid off, it is going to be a substantial amount of funding for that county where this forest exists today. And I thank you, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Tuckman.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Tuckman. I'm with U.S. Forest Capital. We're a forestry and financial services company. And we help both sellers of forest land and buyers look at ways to resolve their natural resource issues and problems, both through private capital markets and through public policy means. And I thought
Representative Burley and Senator Wesson did an outstanding job outlining the parameters of this bill. I've spoken to all of you on a number of occasions over a number of years, Senator Fairley, on this, so I'll, in the interest of time, cut short my comments. But I would like to answer, actually, Senator Atkinson's question on enforcement, and I think it's a good one. Typically, you come to legislative bodies and ask for some kind of governmental enforcement mechanism. And indeed, in this case, the enforcement mechanism is the private capital market itself. These transactions are very conservative, meaning this is sort of, I think you may have been alluding to the stage fright, in the sense that buyers, investors in the bonds, lawyers that give their sort of stamp of approval that this is a legitimate deal or not a legitimate deal are very conservative, because when you have $10, $20, $30 million or more in debt out there, you want to make sure that two things are going to take place. One is your public purpose has been achieved, because if your public purpose is taken away, and I'm going to get into that back to that in a second, your tax advantage is taken away and you have to pay penalties. You have to pay back your foregone rate of interest plus penalties. The other thing you want to make sure is that your revenues can be, you know, your interest income and income can be, principal and interest can be paid. And so you want to make sure that the revenues that are projected from that property are paid. And so what we did, working again with timber industry, conservation community, local opinion leaders, was come up with three public purposes that are equally important. Renewable commercial forest resource management. That was something we used the word renewable commercial resources on purpose to resolve or to help answer your question about how do you mandate, if you will, timber harvest. Community stability, to my knowledge, Senator Farrell, you might be able to educate me. I think besides the ONC lands, this is the only statute I know of that actually has a community stability mandate in it. And then sound conservation practices. So bond counsel are going to be looking at whether you achieve those public purposes as well as whether you can service your debt. We hope you'd support this bill. We've been talking about it for a couple sessions now. We think with 1 million acres having changed hands in Oregon over the last 18 months that that's likely to continue, and that there are municipalities and local groups that might want to take advantage of this. Answer any further questions you might have.
Questions from the panel?
Just a quick one.
Senator Shields.
Bill, you said after the bonds are paid off, it'll be a substantial asset for the community. Hey, how long would the bonds on this take to pay off? And could you describe that asset a little more?
I would refer that to Tom.
The bonds we're looking at are probably 30 to 40 year bonding authority. So it's a substantial period of time. Some of our mill owners that are supportive of this are supportive because it will help, they actually think that it will help them with their financing needs. If there's a sense of certainty that there's going to be fiber supply, their opportunity to finance their improvements are enhanced as well.
Senator Farrelly.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I was out of the room when the discussion regarding some mechanism of guaranteeing a sustainable harvest were discussed. I wonder if I could ask for a brief recap on that issue. How does this bill guarantee we'll have harvest?
I'm going to get into finance terms here, but it guarantees it because these are revenue bonds, not general obligation bonds. In other words, these bonds are going to be issued because we've done the due diligence that shows that timber harvest will produce revenues to pay principal and interest over that 30 to 40 year period. These are not general obligation bonds. In other words, they are not on the back of the taxpayer. They're on back of the project itself, if that's clear. So it's a private capital market mechanism to maintain the working forest, because that's the public purpose here in community stability. But the way you finance that acquisition, the reason there is no governmental funds used is because it is on the back of the project itself. I'm trying to simplify, is that clear, Senator? More detail.
I'm Chair, that's clear as far as it goes, but I imagine that other sources of revenue would be available. Fee hunting, for instance?
If fee hunting could enhance your returns, so could recreation. Again, Senator, I know you're in this business, so I'm preaching to the choir a little bit. As you know, with timberland valuation, a lot is made out of that value added, but the fact is on most transactions, 90-95% of your revenue comes from your timberland return and not your there's talk about carbon credits and all kinds of alternative revenues, but the fact is in terms of valuations, people are looking at, you know, does an asset have a history of producing revenues? What is that history? In many cases, there's 100-year histories in Oregon, and that's what they're going to be banking on. That's what they're going to be buying the debt on, not a speculative return down the road.
Madam Chair, if the issue is for some, at least in this building, the concern is that between grants for carbon sequestering or sequestration, fee hunting, grazing, and recreational leases, that it would be possible, although pretty tough, to retire the bonds with non-natural resource production capabilities. And that's even a little convoluted. I just made it clear.
Yeah, no.
Non-timber harvest.
Yeah.
So why don't you say it in the bill?
We did attempt to do that, and we actually thought we put in language that made it even tougher. I'm reading under the definition of community forest land. Community forest lands means private lands that are zoned, and this is what we inserted, and permanently managed for commercial forest land use. And then later in the Section 2, it talks about to provide the people of the state of Oregon with renewable commercial forest resources. So we made some amendments that we felt addressed that in a very, very strong language.
Okay. Further questions, Senator Farrell?
No, it just seems like an awful lot of convolution to get to the issue of timber harvesting. These lands will be dedicated to sustained timber harvesting.
Senator, the ironic thing about that is that that was some of the first language we came up with, and the folks we were working with wanted stronger language. They felt that this was stronger language. We are open to that, however, given the shortness of time. It would be very difficult to make those amendments right now, and we would hope that this tool, this vehicle, would be available for us to use to work with communities, in the next year or two.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2729? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2729. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3083. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill? Senator Metzger, Representative Vaki, and why don't you guys come on forward, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 3083A specifies that a person working for a news organization is not liable for the criminal offense of refusing to assist in firefighting operations if the newsman or newswoman disobeys a lawful order of a firefighter or peace officer in order to provide news coverage.
All right.
Madam Chair, Brad Avakian, State Representative of Washington County, thank you very much for holding the hearing today. I also want to thank Senator Ringo in his absence for co-sponsoring the bill with Senator Metzger and I. To sum it up, the bill simply creates a standard for balancing the interests of reporters' First Amendment rights and gaining access to fire zones in order to report, and the authority at the scene being able to have the discretion when there is a chance of unreasonable interference to stop the reporter from entering. I might add the statute is much stricter than those of our neighboring states that allow full access to reporters, and that when this bill was heard on the House side, there was no opposition to the bill. Now, you're going to hear some testimony from Charlie Stone from the Department of Forestry, who has really been a great partner in putting this bill together, and he's going to give you some written testimony that he believes is the legislative intent behind the term unreasonable interference. I've read it very carefully, his statement, and I agree with what's in it.
Thank you. Senator Metzger.
Thank you. Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. Appreciate Representative Krupp and Representative Avakian's and people's work on the House side. Very briefly, just as Representative Avakian said, this is just to ensure that the public has access through the media for firefighting operations, at the same time respecting the fact that they can't interfere with those operations, but that individuals do not use the law unnecessarily to restrict public access and visibility to what is going on in our state.
Senator Metzger, Representative Rockin, has this been a problem in our state before? Are news reporters being sued for not participating? And
well, if I could answer that, it's not the participating. They use the fact that the lawful obeying of an order to basically keep people out of an area has been the issue. And no, it has not been a universal problem. The problem is it happens in different jurisdictions, different individuals, depending on who's in command, depending on their comfort zone, I guess, to having media people observe what they're doing. But it has happened frequently enough. I know in my days in television news, it happened frequently enough that it became a real problem to find any consistency to be able to cover these events. And this will provide that consistency.
I would add only that this issue has come up in the context, too, of what legal rights do the news agencies have and would they take against the state of Oregon, and this was our attempt in some respects to avoid a lawsuit against the state of Oregon.
Senator Farrell.
The issue of the access is a tough one. Incident commanders have an awful lot of responsibility, and they're certainly responsible for the safety of people on the site. And the disobeying of lawful orders, I would not want that to become a debate in the field, where, for instance, an incident commander says to people, pull back. This isn't a defensible area. You're in harm's way. Pull back. And somebody in that group with media credentials says, well, I don't have to, and you can't order me to, and I'm not going to do that. And I can envision that happen. Matter of fact, I think it happens already. Is there any protection for the incident commander if a person who disobeys the incident commander's lawful order to stay out of a site gets injured or harmed because of their insistence on staying in that area? Is there any indemnification for the incident commander and the firefighters or the police if that person with a news credential puts themselves in harm's way against the orders of the incident commander, gets hurt?
There's nothing specific in this bill with regard to indemnification, nor do I think there should be. There is a multitude of law outside of this that deals with people who assume their own risk, which is something that reporters do every day when they enter war zones, fire zones, other types of dangerous situations.
Senator Farrell.
Thank you, Representative Vakin. What I hear you saying is that that there's no circumstance that you're aware of where a news person with credentials who disobeys the lawful order of an incident commander and stays in harm's way, who gets injured, could turn around and bring a claim against the incident commander because the incident commander should have reasonably known that that person was in harm's way and took every action to remove them from harm's way, notwithstanding the issue of the permissive issue of
Sounds like a great bar exam question.
Yes, it does.
Could you respond?
Yeah, on the bar exam, a lot of times they give you multiple choice answers. I don't know if, Senator, you want to throw me out a few options. What I've done with this bill, I've been very careful to use a broad term of unreasonable interference so that the incident commander has discretion at the scene. With regard to any number of 1,000 different special circumstances on what that commander does and what the other individual does, I don't think we should sit here like a court and try and figure it out. This bill simply creates a balance while at the same time giving discretion to the incident commander. I think that's a good place for us to be.
Thank you. And committee staff, would, as we were discussing, the answer to your question, Senator Farrell, is that anybody can sue anybody, but it's not likely that in this case that the reporter would prevail. So,
Well, of course, they were in your county. No. Yes, Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. As we talk about the paparazzi firefighting bill here. Line 12, the word unreasonably, I think, makes this more complicated than it needs to be. Because if you take away, I mean, I can infer from this that it's okay to reasonably interfere with a firefighting operation. Why don't we just strike the word unreasonable altogether and just say, if you work for a news organization or if you're reporting on a fire and you don't interfere with firefighting operations? To me, that's clear. But to have the word unreasonably, you do not unreasonably interfere, means that somehow, if it's not unreasonable, there is a way to reasonably interfere with firefighting.
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, the reason the word is there is because there is a balancing of legal rights here between the government and incident command and the First Amendment constitutional rights of the freedom of the press. And so there is a balance, if you want to call it a conflict of interests. All this does is set a standard for those.
Well, thank you, but I've been on big fires, and the last thing that an incident commander has to do is manage media. I mean, so that's just my opinion. So, thanks.
Reasonable. Okay. Thank you, Representative Rockian.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We will come back to this bill. We're close temporarily. The public hearing on 3083. You're just jealous, Senator Atkinson, because nobody follows you around with a TV camera.
Oh. that hurts.
It may. We'll see. I'm going to go back up to, I know I've got some folks that need to leave on 2976, so let's open a public hearing on 2976.
Yeah, the problem with that bill, Madam Chair, is if I were standing on fire, no members of the press would put the fire out.
That's true. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill, and then proponents, why don't you guys come on up? Good. Ms. Fuller, Mr. Stecker, and Ms. Skye, why don't you come up as well?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. House Bill 2976A comes to us from the House Judiciary Committee. It modifies the crime of criminal non-support and provides that a lawful excuse for failing to provide child support becomes an affirmative defense to a crime.
All right. Mr. Stecker, Ms. Fuller.
From paparazzis to deadbeat.
Madam Chair, Senator Atkinson, my name is Carl Stecker. I'm in the Marion County District Attorney's Office. And I'm here today in support of House Bill 2976, which comes from the House with several amendments at the request, I believe, of Ms. Skye, that enabled the defendant in a criminal non-support action to have the burden of coming forth with an affirmative defense. And that affirmative defense is that of having a lawful excuse, which has been defined in the statute as a situation not of the defendant's own making. And the reason for this is that as the statute was currently written and before prior to this bill, it requires the state to prove that a defendant had no lawful excuse. And so it's the proof of a negative. And that means developing a vast array of potential defenses and trying to anticipate them. And in light of, for example, HIPAA and some other laws, information that is uniquely within the province of the defendant's own ability to bring forth information that the state cannot necessarily find with any ease. So this simply, the amendments require a culpability standard of knowingly fails. The state still has to prove that someone knows about the support order and that they failed to provide it, but it at least shifts the burden to the person to come forward with the affirmative defense that of some inability or disability.
Thank you. Ms. Fuller, you wish to add anything?
Yes, Chair Brown, members of the committee. My name is Shaney Fuller. I'm with the Department of Justice Oregon Child Support Program. Just very quickly, criminal non-support is a last resort for the Oregon Child Support Program in terms of our enforcement remedies. We have an entire list of enforcement remedies, and this is one that we would use when all others have failed and an obligor is shown to be unwilling to pay, not simply unable. And this bill and the change in the required burden of proof would not change that or how it's used in the program. As mentioned, we do understand that the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association is fundamentally opposed to this policy choice. However, we did work with them for an amendment on the House side. It lessened the burden of proof for the affirmative defense for the defendant, and at the request of the Judiciary Committee, we also further amended the bill to add the culpable mental state of knowingly fails. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Skye, uphill battle since I used to do this kind of work, and going after folks that did not pay their child support was very frustrating. With that, take it away.
Okay.
Sorry.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Skye. I'm the legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we do oppose this bill because of its burden-shifting nature. And I do agree with the proponents that they have already amended it to take care of some of our concerns. The last remaining concern is that of the shifting burden. And what's important to remind the members of the committee is that when you're charged with a crime in this country, you're presumed to be innocent, and it's the state's burden to prove that you're guilty of that crime. There are a few situations where defenses to a crime become what's called an affirmative defense, and that is where the defendant actually does have a burden to prove that they meet the requirements of the defense. And one of the most common defenses that you would be aware of that is an affirmative defense is the defense of guilty except for insanity. So if a person wants to assert that, then it is that defendant's burden to prove that they meet the legal requirements of that defense. This bill seeks to do just that, to shift the burden onto the defendant in these criminal non-support cases. And our concern is that the way the statute is written, it is so broad. To knowingly fail to provide child support for a child, that could be, you could fall into that category if you were in custody of the Department of Corrections, if you were homeless and unemployed, disabled. There are all kinds of things that could make you unable to pay child support, but you would still be subject to the initiation of prosecution under this statute. Currently, what the law provides, and I read the most recent cases in preparation for this hearing, currently what the Court of Appeals requires for the state to prove is that there is a court-mandated order to pay, and that the person has an ability to generate income and, in fact, has earned wages during the time period, and that there have been no payments in any amount. The two most recent cases, State versus Eagle out of the Court of Appeals in April of this year, upheld that where the state only showed that the person had made a payment, that they were still employable and had stopped making payments, that was enough to uphold a conviction under the current statute without the change that's asked for today. We believe that is adequate. And I understand and I believe the people who are sitting at this table that they will use the statute as last resort and when all other means have failed. But those requirements are not written into this statute, and we are leaving it to the discretion of the state to only use this as a last resort or not to use it against somebody who does have a legal excuse. So in so doing, the state can actually initiate a prosecution, require the person to hire an attorney to defend themselves or have the court pay for an attorney to defend them when they may have a legal excuse. So by taking that burden, putting it on the defendant, you are subjecting them to the initiation of prosecution and the requirement to defend themselves under a very broad statute, and that is our concern.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Strecker, do you wish to respond?
Well, with respect to, and due deference to Ms. Skye's interpretation of those recent cases, the language in that case really just suggested that those were some ways by which the state might prove. It wasn't a mandate in that in those court decisions as to the method of proof. It merely made one suggestion as to a way that the state might choose to prove the case. The elements of the crime remain simply that a person is a parent or guardian of a child under 18 and refuses without lawful excuse or neglects to provide the support that's been required. And beyond that, I think that we can make a strong analogy with the contempt statutes. In the contempt process, we have the remedy of incarceration, and certainly in that instance, in those cases, the inability to pay is an affirmative defense. And so we usually just use criminal non-support in instances where the state can't reach beyond its borders, and we have an individual who is a resident of another state for whom contempt as a remedy doesn't lie. Frankly, we only prosecute in the range of hundreds of these cases versus literally hundreds of thousands of child support cases. So we don't have the resources to bring manifold actions of this nature. They're just used in extraordinary situations and in cases where we can't gain the cooperation usually of another state. And so this remedy ultimately leads to diversions and usually agreements that the people will pay, and if they meet the terms of probation, the case gets dismissed.
Okay. Questions for the panel? Ms. Skye, good job. At least you made me think about it. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2976 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2596. Mr. Long, whoever else wants to come on out. I need to leave for a meeting. I'm going to let Senator Farioli take over. So,
don't take over.
I don't have a point.
It would be difficult. And the sign-up sheets are on my clipboard here. So, like, if we've been to a bill, it's already there.
Chair Farioli, as she, Madam Chair, walks out the door. I'm Angie Dilks, for the record, with on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association. The electrical industry brings this bill forward to you. It allows the Building Codes Division to work with the Engineers Board to determine whether or not an engineer is needed on non-complex work. We worked with the engineers on the House side to come up with the language contained in the bill today, and as far as we're aware anyway, all parties are in agreement with the solution. So we would ask for your support.
Thank you. Any further testimony? Any questions? Go ahead, if you want to make a statement for the record.
No, Mr. Chair. Mark Long with Building Codes Division. Yes. Angie's done a great job, and we're in agreement.
Thank you. Then we'll go ahead and close the vote. Is there any other person here present that wishes to offer testimony on House Bill 2596? Anybody else signed up? Seeing none, close the public hearing on House Bill 2596. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3050. Do you have a sign up sheet on House Bill 3050?
I think it's coming.
Mr. Vice Chair and Committee, House Bill 3050A authorizes students studying dentistry and dental hygiene at educational institutions outside of the state to engage in community-based or clinical studies within Oregon.
Mr. Ricks, do you wish to present first, or shall we listen to the testimony of Ms. Landau?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Doug Riggs with the Oregon Primary Care Association. I'll just point out real quickly that OPCA represents 24 federally qualified health centers throughout Oregon. We have we saw 180,000 patients last year and 800,000 visits, and we have dental, medical, primary, and preventative care. And I think Ms. Landau will outline the bill that passed overwhelmingly in the House.
Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Rebecca Landau, and I'm a consultant with the Oregon Primary Care Association. We're asking for this change in the Dental Practice Act because we have a huge shortage of dental providers in the state. We'd like to provide training opportunities for dentists who are in schools out of the state, as we do currently for students in medicine and nursing and physician assistant studies. And the change is is a relatively minor one. We don't expect to change our standards in terms of accepting quality students, and many of the students that want to come and do a rotation here are Oregonians that are just going to school outside the state. So it's a relatively minor change. We're hoping it'll make a dent in the access to dental services in the long run, and that's our intent.
Questions? Thank you very much. Anyone else here willing, interested in testifying on House Bill 3050? If not, we'll close the public hearing on 3050 or open a public hearing on House Bill 3083.
That's
I already did that.
Firefighting news.
Oh, yeah. The Police and Fire Paparazzi Bill.
Yes.
House Bill 3093 is next on the agenda. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3093. We have Mr. Wilson, Mr. Higginson, and Ron, is it Murray?
Yes.
Please come forward. And Ms. Harris, would you explain the purpose of the bill briefly?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Do I say chair when you're acting as chair? That seems more natural.
Whichever feels comfortable.
Okay.
Tiffany, that'll be fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3093A specifies that the Department of Human Services cannot require a journeyman plumber or an apprentice plumber to obtain certain certifications in order to inspect cross connections or test backflow prevention device assemblies.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, member of the committee. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing the Plumbing, Heating, Cooling Contracting Association of Oregon. We support the A. Engrossed version along with 290. That was a joint effort between us that passed the bill, passed the House unanimously. The bill simply says that journeymen and apprentice plumbers do not need to have certification from the Department of Human Services for its cross-connection program. Currently, plumbers are regulated by DCBS and the State Plumbing Board in all areas of their scope and practice, with the exception of inspecting and testing backflow devices. And House Bill 3093 simply says that plumbers are plumbers. They spend thousands of hours in training and are more than capable of the relatively simple task of inspecting and testing backflow assemblies without having to undergo certification and regulation from an agency that's unrelated to the plumbing profession. It's what we'd call a regulatory streamlining issue in the plumbing industry, and that's why 290 and PHCC support the bill. Now, having said that, we did agree to talk with the Department of Human Services to allay any concerns that plumbers have the necessary training to do this. So we have talked with the department to include language that would allow the director of DCBS to adopt a rule to require plumbers to complete a state-approved training program. It does go against the grain of the bill, I'd say, but it was something that we were willing to entertain. We do not have that amendment back yet, but we did make a commitment to DHS to entertain that. Thank you.
Go ahead and proceed. Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, member of the committee, Ms. Harris. My name is Ron Murray. I represent the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters of the United States and Canada. And I would concur with the previous testimony that we have worked collaboratively with plumbing, heating, cooling contractors for this bill. Backflow devices are plumbing devices installed under benefit of a plumbing permit by a licensed plumber, as is the current statute in the state of Oregon. And we would concur with his comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Higginson.
And Mr. Higginson. Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the Office Administrator for Community Health and Health Planning within the Department of Human Services. Currently, one of the programs that I run, the Backflow Prevention Program, Cross Connection Program, does serve to certify both plumbers and independent testers of backflow assemblies. Plumbers make up about 15% of those people who are certified. As you've already heard, the bill would take the plumbers out of our certification system and have any certification done through the building codes, DCBS. We have no conceptual problems with this bill. However, I did on the House side testify that we had some concerns, and they were really around ensuring that there are minimums in the way of standards for training and recertification, and making sure that there's coordination between our certification program and that being done in DCBS. With the conceptual amendments that Mr. Wilson has talked about, we would not have any problems with the bill and have been working with not only these two partners but also other stakeholders to make sure that everyone's okay.
Dr. Higginson, is anyone, are you particularly or anyone else aware of any opposition to the bill?
Chair Ferrioli, as I said, we've tried to include a number of stakeholders, and I believe at least the vast majority of people are at least okay with the current status of the bill, assuming that those amendments go forward. I cannot tell you whether or not there are some people who might be still opposed.
If I may add, Mr. Chair, Ron Murray again. We've been working on this bill for 6 years, and my understanding is, as of late Friday afternoon, anyone that might oppose the bill has agreed that the amendments would soothe their concerns, and I could say that there is, at this point, no opposition to the amended bill.
Mr. Wilson, is that your understanding?
Thank you. Sure.
Any questions from the panel?
No.
Thank you. Anyone else here present wishing to testify on House Bill 3093? Thank you very much. Seeing, hearing none. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3093. I'm going to reopen the hearing on House Bill 3083, and I believe Senator, is that the bill that you wish to testify on? We'll move forward to that in a moment. Mr. Stone, did you want to testify on House Bill 3083? Open the public hearing on House Bill 3083.
Good afternoon, Chair Ferrioli, member of the committee. For the record, I'm Charlie Stone, Projects Director for the Protection from Fire Program with the Department of Forestry. I'll try to move this right along. As the bill was originally introduced, the department had considerable concerns with it. We've worked with Representative Avakian to bring us to a neutral position on the bill. The main point that I wanted to make here this afternoon is, as he pointed out, the interpretation of what is unreasonable interference on a fire ground. When we have a large fire or intermediate-sized fire, we set up an organization specifically for incident information. We have folks that can escort the media safely around the fire ground. We have regular briefings. That's not always the case when we have initial attack-type situations, but the incident commander has that authority and the responsibility to deal with incident information. To us, reasonable participation or interference, if you want, reasonable would be to check in with the fire authorities and make sure that their presence is known, and to find out where it's safe to be or to be escorted by firefighters. To not do that, to not check in, to roam around the fire freely on their own, or to ignore where they should and shouldn't be from a safety standpoint, certainly could result in unreasonable interference in our view. Firefighting is a hazardous business. Our tactics in themselves are hazardous at times. When you talk about dropping 1,000 gallons of water from the sky or lighting a burnout operation, we need to know where everybody is on the fire. The firefighters are in constant communication, evaluating the situation, the weather, the terrain, etc. And if there's somebody out there that suddenly appears in the line of a retardant drop or where a burnout was going to be, At the least bad effect, it could interfere with the ability to stop the fire. At worst, people can get hurt, and we want to make sure that doesn't happen. So I appreciate Representative Avakian's indication of his support for this testimony. If the bill's going to move, we'd appreciate the committee also giving some recognition to an interpretation of unreasonable interference. Thank you.
Okay, well, let's drill into that, Mr. Stone. When you say you would like the committee to give some consideration to the term unreasonable, is it your request that the committee define what is unreasonable?
Is Chair Ferrioli, my intent was simply to, if possible, on the record, get an acknowledgement of our view of what that is and send a signal to those rare individuals who like to make themselves or their closeness to danger the story, and have them understand that they need to play by the rules.
Mr. Stone, would you be willing to put those concerns about the practical application of the term unreasonable into writing for the committee?
Chair Ferrioli, I believe I have in my written testimony. If you'd like to further work on that, certainly.
Just incorporated that by reference. The whole point, I think, is that the problem with the reasonable person rule is that not everybody agrees on reasonable, and not everybody is reasonable. I'm concerned that there be circumstances where there is a dispute about what is reasonable and what is the unreasonable exercise of your authority or the incident commander's authority in the field in real time where people are in harm's way. So I appreciate the fact that you've taken pains to describe what you think is reasonable, and it is incorporated in the public record by reference. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else here to testify on 3083? Yes, please come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Armstrong here representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association and also the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. With all due respect to the bill's sponsors, both of the organizations I represent find ourselves in a position of opposition to House Bill 3083. I want to be clear, however, that Representative Akian has gone out of his way to talk to us about possible fixes to this. It's our conclusion, however, that we can't really come to any agreement on language. We do have a couple of suggestions that Ms. Ingram, sitting to my right, will be able to address, but we continue to have a position of opposition. Senator Ferrioli, most of our concerns are along the same lines as your line of questioning. The current language is very concrete. It talks about disobeying an order. The proposed language talks about unreasonable interference, and therein lies our concern. We believe that the incident commander needs to have absolute ultimate authority, and there can be no qualification to that. There can be no dispute. It just simply needs to be for the sake of not only the safety of the firefighting personnel but also of the media. So we find ourselves in a position of opposition. We're encouraging the committee to reject House Bill 3083 unless there is some way to deal with some additional amendments, as Ms. Ingram has. So with that, I'll answer any questions.
Questions from the panel?
Thank you, Chair Ferrioli and committee member. The Oregon Fire District Directors Association. Jenna Ingram, Oregon Fire District Directors Association, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, Clackamas County Fire District 1. The Oregon Fire District Directors Association does oppose House Bill 3083, because it does exempt certain persons from the commission of the Class B Class B violation for intentionally disobeying an order from the incident commander. We don't believe there is any circumstances where the incident commander's order should be disobeyed. There are a number of circumstances that maybe the public is not aware of. There could be, they could suspect a bomb or something, and people are not aware of that, and they could say, well, I'm you know, far enough back away from the fire, I can go forward, when there could be other circumstances that they're not aware of. We're concerned about hindrance of the operation. We're also concerned, even after the fire is out, that the presence of people on the scene could interfere with the investigation, the ongoing investigation of what caused the fire. And then foremost, we're concerned about the safety factors involved. And we are very keenly aware of the question, Senator Ferrioli, that you brought up about the liability issue. There's a lot of pressure on an incident commander in a situation such as we're describing, and it just seems unrealistic that even if you are able to define what is reasonable or unreasonable, that the incident commander is going to have the time in the midst of all that's going on to stop and check the credentials and make sure somebody is actually a member of the press, or if they're just not walking onto the scene and saying, I'm a member of the press, let me through. That's going to take time for them to stop, to verify the credentials, and we just don't feel that that is in the best interest of the public. We have suggested some alternative language that is in my written testimony to the effect that the incident commander may not deny a person working for a news organization access to a firefighting operation unless, in the judgment of the incident commander, the presence of the person would reduce safety or compromise security, investigative procedures, or the firefighting operation itself. We feel that that makes our position a little better. However, we're still in the position of having the incident commander stop and verify whether or not somebody is a bona fide member of the press, and that presents a very big problem. We don't feel that they should take the time to do that when there are other more weighty situations that they should be dealing with. Again, that is the position of the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, Tualatin Valley Fire, Clackamas 1. I've also asked to mention that the League of Oregon Cities is also in opposition to House Bill 3083 as written. And that concludes my testimony, and I thank you for your time.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Dave Fiskum, representing the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. It's possible that I should not be sitting up at the same panel with my colleagues to my left. But at the same time, I'm pleased to do so. The OAB is an association of 200 radio and television stations throughout the state. I'm here to tell you, for the record, that we do support the bill that Representative Bakian led in the development of on the House side, where I would also hasten to add, for the record, that there was no opposition. I think, as Representative Bakian and Senator Metzger outlined to you, the language here does represent a decent balancing test of two tough issues, which is media access to cover public events and in public interest, as well as the responsibility of those who manage such firefighting locations to bar access if intervention or interference is involved. I was unaware, frankly, until today, of opposition to this bill. So be it. No harm, no foul. At the same time, my colleagues to my left have outlined some language that they think we ought to consider. I'm speaking for the association, and I can't speak for Representative Avakian, obviously, but we'd be pleased to consider that to see if there is room for middle ground here that we could establish that would achieve the objective important to the association I represent, which is access to fire scenes in an appropriate and reasonable manner. Testimony on the House side of persons with TV cameras who were prevented from such access and thought that was unreasonable. That's a judgment call. That testimony is not provided to you today, but I'm here to tell you that if there is room for movement here or room for a final compromise before the end of this session, we'd be pleased to be involved in that. And with that, Mr. Chair and member, I will stop. Thank you.
Questions? Anyone else? Yes, Senator.
Since I'm anonymously known as member, I could say what I was saying. It seems it's come late to the table, but this bill has ignited a firestorm of opposition in the latter moment.
I would prefer to stay, if I were you, I'd prefer to say anonymous too.
Yes, thank you very much.
It seems
seriously, why so late? In opposition. Why didn't you bring these concerns to the House?
Chair Ferrioli, Senator Shields, thank you for the question. It's a very valid one. We were aware of amendments that and the depths and the lengths that Representative Bakian was going to try to make the bill better. Frankly, we did voice our opposition privately, but we're trying to give them the courtesy of giving us something that we thought we could live with. We took the language back, the new and improved bill back, the Angros version, to our members, and it just is not acceptable. We were trying to give them the courtesy of coming up with something that we thought we could live with. Much to the consternation, I might add, both Mr. Armstrong and I took a pretty good little beating from our members for not being more vocal, but we were trying to give them the opportunity to make it better.
Reacting to Mr. Fiskum's testimony, perhaps the best thing that could happen is that earlier rather than later you can connect with Representative Avakian and discuss the proposed language. I think the whole thing turns on Today, the fire chiefs have absolute authority to order people in the incident. The incident commander is in charge of the incident. Creation of the affirmative defense, unfortunately, also interjects the reasonable man rule, and that's endlessly debatable. It looks like your language would require that the incident commander make a determination that the presence of the media would hinder firefighting activities and compromise the safety of firefighters or the media person, and that's a much, I think, easier standard to understand. Go ahead.
If I may, Chair Farioli, one of the concerns that our members had as well was that we feel that the language currently in the Angros bill is so vague that we can't train to it. We wanted something concrete so that we're able to train the incident commanders. My clients are able to train the incident commanders so that they are able to make a better judgment call. This whole reasonable, unreasonable, we can't train to that standard.
Mr. Chair, Ken Armstrong, Fire Chiefs. The only thing I would add to that is that before this bill hit the floor of the House, we began discussing with Representative Avakian ways to potentially resolve our conflict with this language, believing, I think, that there was some room for discussion. I think you heard this morning or this afternoon from Representative Avakian that he believes that this language provides better protection for us than under current statute. We respectfully disagree with that, take a contrary position, and so that's why there's been this lack of ability to get together on language.
And, Mr. Chair, my last word is that I think we need to keep in our minds that the public interest is served by appropriate and reasonable media access to cover events the public cares about. There's a balancing test inherent in those words, and I fully respect that. We've worked on such issues before in the past. Our association has, with helicopter coverage of crime scenes in Portland, with, in fact, to state one example from two sessions ago, I believe, the issue of, in the event of a capital punishment occurrence at the prison, the media access to such an event as that. I think we have a history in this state of being able to work out appropriate compromises that, in fact, provide for, if not guarantee, media access without that being related to interfering with those events as they go forward, or in this case with fire managers. So I think we have some chance to do that, and perhaps, Mr. Chair, time will tell. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate it. It sounds like Senator Shields is on to something here, and that is that even though it's late in the sessions, perhaps there's still time to come to closure on the compromise language and bring it. That will ask if there's anyone else here present that wishes to testify.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
3083, if not, close the public hearing. Senator Westland, you're here for 1051. Open a public hearing on 1051. Following that, we'll turn to the issue that brings Senator Beyer to the floor. We'll have the sign-up sheets, please, for 1051. And Ms. Harris, would you orient the committee, please?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1051 creates a task force on the Oregon Health Plan.
Senator, welcome. And for the record, and we're also going to call Mr. Bishop, and he represents the Oregon Hospital Association. If you could come up. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Senator Ben Westland, District 27. And what I'd like to point out is that Senate Bill 1051 is my original bill introduced through the good offices of the Rules Committee. Fortunately, this bill with the broad relating to clause was drafted too narrowly to be useful and has since been supplemented with Senate Bill 819 to create the task force. That's a long way of saying I'm trying to gut and stuff my own bill. What the Dash 1 amendments do is allow Oregon physicians, only while seeing Oregon health plan patients, the same immunities as provided OHSU physicians while seeing all patients.
The nexus, I think, should be obvious. OHSU is a public institution funded in part with taxpayer dollars. Physicians seeing OHP patients are paid entirely with taxpayer dollars. The Oregon Tort Claims Act authorizes tort actions against public bodies. By law, the state cannot be sued unless it grants permission, which the state does by waiving sovereign immunity up to, and I believe this figure is correct, $300,000. Mr. Chair, committee members, the state does not allow its officers, agents, or employees to be named in a suit while acting in the public's behalf. My question to all of us is, why should physicians acting in the public interest while seeing Oregon Health Plan patients be treated any differently? Part of this is a fairness issue, of course, but it is also an access to health care issue for Oregon Health Plan patients. More and more physicians are finding it more and more difficult to see Oregon Health Plan patients at 45, 50 cents on the dollar, while they are still required to fund 100% of the insurance cost for going tort claims. I make no illusions, have no illusions, that this is a simple issue, that there are not significant challenges to this bill, but it is one which I think we should take up and one that I think we should consider. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Bishop.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We've submitted written testimony for the committee's consideration on the original bill. We have not looked at it, considered the -1 amendments. Our request was that the committee, if it decided to advance a measure on a task force, broaden the participation to include providers who are responsible for serving the Oregon Health Plan enrollees. So we're addressing the original bill, not the amendment.
Is there implications for other healthcare providers also that happen to be seeing OHP patients? Dentists, for instance?
Hospitals, for instance, I think yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any questions from the committee?
I mean, the math is relatively the same and the logic still holds true.
Yeah.
For all healthcare providers seeing Oregon Health Plan patients.
Well, and I guess I was wondering if there would be a reason to not, perhaps to think about charging the task force with one of the questions or a series of questions that talks to all of the rural health care providers and health care providers that provide services under OHP. Do you think that will be a fairly inclusive discussion with the task force?
It must be. Under Senate Bill 819, which is becoming the task force bill. This was laying off on the side shelf, and then the relating to clause, you know, presented itself for the OHP immunity concept, as I call it. And in my remarks, I probably was too limiting. Your point is very astute, Mr. Chair. Well, it should be.
I think there was a reason for that. It was brought by Ms. Harris. Okay. Question, Senator Shields?
I'm trying to catch up here. We're just considering the bill, or are we considering amendments?
I would ask that you, the amendments, which apparently have not been provided, so you are going to get some amendments with my highly illegible scribbles on them that really translate into the beginning of my remarks to this committee. What they do is they gut and stuff my own bill. They take out the task force and they put in the OHP immunity concept.
So I saw Katie heading out the door to make copies of
that. That's right, yes. This is the first we heard of the amendments.
All right, so this will be an exercise in foreshadowing, Senator, and the amendments are going to be produced and brought to the committee.
Very good.
Meanwhile, what we'll do is we'll just recess the public hearing on 1051 and come back to it when the amendments are ready. Senator Beyer, you're here to speak on the issue of Senate Bill 2729. We'll reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2729.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have, hopefully you have in your packets, a dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2729 that I had authored after hearing the bill the first time in the Senate Land Use and Environment Committee. And if you do not have those in your possession, then I will make sure that the committee gets them. And
Let me just clarify with the committee. We do not have the dash A2 amendments.
When the amendments are requested by the Office of an individual legislator, sometimes they don't find their way to me, so sometimes I don't know that they're
the
out
dash
there.
Amendments are what?
A2s.
I've got them.
Well, they were presented to the committee staff for the Senate Land Use and Environment Committee when the bill was in that.
The former committee would have them.
When the bill was in that venue.
We will take them down. Sorry.
Thank you. I can make a copy available.
And here is a copy, courtesy of Senator Shields.
Okay. Thanks.
So, again, you don't have the amendments I'm going to be speaking to, but I would just like, I understand you already held the public hearing on this bill today, and I was unavailable, and I appreciate the courtesy of reopening the public hearing to allow me to introduce the A2 amendments. They do gut and stuff the bill, but they actually make very minor changes to the bill, and I'll speak to those changes. The proponents of the bill in the Land Use Committee spoke to the community forest land and what that means, and the fact that this is forest lands that would be managed in a commercial use, and the harvesting of the timber would pay back the bonds that bought the forest land. Nowhere in the bill could I find anything that spoke of harvest. So I had added to that definition that of community forest lands, it would say a sub B that have continuous growth and harvest of forest resources that produce revenue sufficient for repayments of revenue bonds and other obligations issued under Section 8 of this Act. So it's simply where this amendment is drafted as a gut and stuff, there it makes very minor changes to the bill. The other thing that it does is if you look at Section 5 of the bill, there were terms used of business interests and conservation interests, and those were undefined terms. I had definitions put to those terms. Business interest means entities that are engaged in forest-related businesses, trades, occupations, or professions in pursuit of financial gain, and conservation interest means entities that are engaged in or interested in the management of land, water, and natural resources for the purposes of meeting human and ecological needs in a sustainable manner. Had those two terms defined. The other issue in that same section was in the original draft of the bill that a minority of the members of the Forest Authority Board could make decisions on behalf of the entire board. It said that a majority of members present had presented or made a quorum, but a majority of those members could pass resolutions or acts on behalf of the entire board. Change that so that a majority of members of the entire board would be needed to take action on an issue. Those are the changes in the bill that I have offered. I think that with those changes, it becomes a good product, and hopefully the committee, when you take up a work session, will entertain the dash A2 amendments. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the panel? Did you have a chance to discuss the amendments with the proponent?
I have discussed at length with Representative Burley. His feeling specifically on the harvest of issue is that it is not needed to be in the law because the bonds authority would require harvest. My concern over that is the fact that if it is not in the law, there would be no way to enforce if the harvest never occurs on the forest land. And we disagree on that issue, Representative Burley and I do.
What about the concern over the proponents, or the concern of the proponents, that coming late in the session, we hope it's late in the session, that the issue might run into procedural problems and become fouled in the process and not make it through the legislature.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that concern. I too hope we are late in the process, but having said that, if we amend the bill, it is a next day concurrence vote in the Senate, and if this draft does represent the interests and what the proponents have stated that they support, which is harvesting these forest lands to repay the bonds, if it makes it clear, I don't believe a one-day delay is going to hurt this bill at all.
Okay. Further questions? The the HB 2729-A2 amendments have been distributed to committee members, and I'll affix a note to the file for the chairman that Your testimony was in reference to the A2 amendments.
Thank you, Mr.
Any other person that wishes to testify?
Yeah, I have it.
On House Bill 2729. Seeing that, we'll close the public hearing on 2729. Since we have the amendment, the dash one amendment on Senate Bill 1051, we'll reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 1051. The gentleman who brought the amendment is not in the room.
That's okay. It's news you lose. We're here. Want to change the rules?
Well, let's see if he's in the hallway.
Is he in Senate rules?
Yes.
Here's some more testimony. How many more bills are there?
Senator Westland testified that this is essentially a substitution of the original bill. Which adds the clauses relating to positions for agents of the Department of Human Services. We'll just note that the Senate Bill 1051-1 amendments have been distributed to the members. Is he available?
They're calling to see if he might be able to run down if he wasn't outside.
Okay. Meanwhile, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1051. We'll go to Senate Bill 1076. We'll have the sign-up sheets, and Ms. Harris will orient the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1076 modifies the term of office for members of the Oregon Health Policy Commission. It's a commission appointed by the governor.
And we have Gretchen Morley and Katie King here to testify in this regard. Welcome. Please proceed.
Chair, Vice Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee. For the record, let me introduce myself. I'm Gretchen Morley, the Director of the Oregon Health Policy Commission. We are here today to voice support for Senate Bill 1076, which is introduced by Senator Morissette on our behalf, to make a few statutory changes to the Oregon Health Policy Commission as well as the Public Health Advisory Board. Both of these, there's two issues that the bill addresses. Both of them, we believe, will make the two bodies function better into the future. I'll address the first issue, and then Katie King of DHS will address the second. The first is that when the Health Policy Commission was created last year, all of the commissioners were appointed at the same time, and then also the terms are clearly specified in the statute, and what we have at this point in time is the possibility that we could have a very large turnover of commission members all at the same time. And so what the bill would do is insert some staggering terms in order to keep that from happening and keep commission business going forward smoothly.
For the record, my name is Katie King. I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Liaison for Health Services in the Department of Human Services. And the piece that speaks to public health, it just removes, this bill would remove the designated seats for the Oregon Health Policy Commission members on the Public Health Advisory Board and open those up for members of the public. And I found out recently when we tried to recruit someone new for the board that the next open public seat is 2008. So we put an emergency clause on this. Okay. And we ask for your support of this bill, please.
Ms. King, is there a reason to have interlocking board of director memberships? Wasn't that designed to sort of cross-pollinate between the folks that were doing public health policy on the commission and those that were doing public health policy on the council?
Yes, that was, Chair Ferrioli, that was the original intent. Over time, however, it became clear that it was a big responsibility to ask folks to serve on two substantive boards. And so for that reason, the governor's office supports this change as well.
Makes sense. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Is there anyone here present who wishes to have an opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 1076? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1076.
HJR 20 is up, I believe. Let us have, Ms. Harris, just a brief overview of HJR 20.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. HJR 20A urges the governor's office to apply to the Commission on Presidential Debates to enable Oregon to host the 2008 general election presidential debate.
And this is with a completely straight face, is it?
That's okay, the plan.
Blair Bavier, Pacific Green Party. Please step forward.
Mr. Chairman, Blair is playing the leader.
Ah, always appreciated, especially by the municipal authorities of the city of Salem. Anyone else here willing wishing to testify on HJR 20? Then we will recess the public hearing on HJR 20, and when the meter is plugged, we will reopen that public hearing. Where are we on the agenda, Ms. Harris?
Well, the agenda that they keep you with my little pen marks.
Okay, then. Okay, my kingdom for a quorum.
Yeah.
The committee will stand at ease for as long as it takes to get the
hearing.
We're in public hearing on HJR 30.
20.
And HJR 20. And we have a witness from who's plugging the meter that wishes to testify.
Okay. Good morning. Good afternoon, Mr. Bobia. Welcome.
Morning. Thank you, Senator. Senator Brown, members of the committee, Blair Bobier for the record, representing the Pacific Green Party of Oregon. I'd like to express our opposition to House Joint Resolution 20A, which would urge the governor's office to apply to the Commission on Presidential Debates to enable Oregon to host the 2008 general election presidential debate. We do so because the commission is not really an independent commission. The commission was founded and operates on the premise that the two candidates representing the two major parties should participate in the debates and, in general, excludes all other candidates. In 1996, 2000, and 2004, there were no independent candidates participating in the general election debate. In 2000, the Green Party candidate, Ralph Nader, despite having a ticket for admission to the debate, was actually arrested on the orders of the debate commission. Public opinion polls show that a majority of people want more candidates in the debates, and approximately 20 to 30% of registered voters are not affiliated with any major or minor political party, and they are therefore shut out of the debates as well. That is our position, quickly and simply, and just ask that you take it into consideration.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Devlin, did you wish to, have you already testified?
No.
Why don't you come on up, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1076.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here today in support of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1076. This proposal adds the charge of examining the issue of childhood obesity to the Oregon Health Policy Commission. Originally, the concept was included in Senate Bill 675, which passed the Senate in April on a vote of 24-2. Childhood obesity is an epidemic in Oregon. 28% of Oregon's 8th graders and 21% of Oregon's 11th graders are obese. Over the last 20 years, the percentage of Oregon teenagers who are overweight has tripled. This is the result of poor nutritional choices, lack of physical activity, and a culture that encourages these unhealthy habits. Obese children are at risk of developing high blood pressure, heart disease, and type 2 diabetes. The bill before you is a first step toward addressing this issue. I've chosen the Health Policy Commission to address this issue based on its legislative mandate as stated in ORS 442.045, Article 8. It is the charge of the Health Policy Commission to act as the primary advisor to the Office of Health Policy and research the governor and the legislature. In sense going from my prepared comments, one of the things I'd like to say is when you look at the Oregon Health Policy Commission, it was looked at to look at several different aspects of health, not only health care, but actually health itself, not only what we might term issues such as insurance, but issues of public health also. The committee itself has identified obesity and childhood obesity as being the number two preventable area of disease that could be addressed. Also, many bills that come before you in a form calling for certain actions to be taken, and then by the end of the session, they become studies. This bill actually is contrary to that pattern. This bill basically started as a study and is still a study. And the reason it is a study is my staff and I spent about 3 to 4 months researching this issue prior to the session, and we felt that there was inadequate information available and inadequate work that had been done to come up with very concrete proposals that could address this issue in a more comprehensive fashion. Secondarily, this amendment to the bill is of limited duration. It would actually sunset after a 2-year period. This amendment merely directs the Health Policy Commission to study and develop a comprehensive plan to reduce childhood obesity in Oregon. This will help create a framework to reduce childhood obesity in our public schools and throughout our communities. Though many solutions to this problem of childhood obesity have been proposed this legislature, very few have actually passed, and some have been so watered down that their significance might be questioned. SB 1076 will open a broad discussion that I believe will lead to a comprehensive strategy. It will allow concerned groups to coordinate their efforts to launch a united front against this epidemic. The purpose of this amendment ultimately is to ensure the health and well-being of Oregon's children in future generations.
All right. Any questions for Senator Devlin?
And I do not believe that any of the senators here were no's on the floor.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Senator Devlin. Anybody else wishing to testify? I appreciate your joining us this afternoon. Public hearing on Senate Bill 1076 is way down. Until then, we'll go into a work session and try and move as many bills as possible.
We'll start with 2614, would you please?
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2315. Senator Shields, are you going to come join us? Chair would move House Bill 2315 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none? So ordered. House Bill 2596, no amendments, correct?
2596, I think there were some amendments that weren't ready.
That weren't ready? Okay, I'll move on. Why don't you check that one? House Bill 2, I'm going to close public hearing on 2315, open a public hearing on House Bill 2772. I believe we have amendments.
You're opening a work session?
2772.
Madam Chair, that was...
Can I open a public hearing?
Yes,
and
you
open
did.
A work
yes.
session. Open a work session on 2772. Ms. Harris.
Thank you. Yes, we have dash seven amendments that were introduced.
Okay. The chair would move the dash seven amendments to House Bill 2772. Any objection?
Hold on. Can't find the bill.
2772, the insurance bill?
Well, that's the realtor?
Yes.
Giddy up.
All right.
That's fine.
Yeah, good bill.
Amendments passed. The chair would move House Bill 2772 as amended to the Senate floor with the new pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
I'd like to hear that.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson, but since I'm a sponsor in the bill, I'm carrying. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2614. We have the dash two amendments. Chair would move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2614. Would you please call the roll?
Hold on a second. I'm looking.
You can go for the amendments. You always vote for the amendments and you vote against the bill.
Is that how it's done?
Sorry, because it's dash two amendments to House Bill 2614.
No.
Okay.
Sorry, see, you're leading me astray is what you're doing. Getting me off less.
Fine.
New.
Oh, yeah.
Chair votes aye.
Yes.
Oh, thank you, President Courtney, for your appearance. Motion carries. Chair would move House Bill 2614 to the Senate floor, as amended, to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Madam Chairman, I'll be voting no and serving notice of a possible minority report.
Great. Relating clause is extremely narrow. I look forward to your minority report. Would you please call the roll?
I know.
Aye.
No.
Chair votes aye.
Yes.
Motion carries. I guess I will carry the bill. We look forward to your minority report.
Thank you, ma'am.
Serve notice. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2729. Senator Beyer has proposed amendments to House Bill 2729. The chair has concerns that if we move those amendments, the bill will literally get bogged down on the House side.
Point of order, ma'am.
Senator Farioli.
In your absence, the question was asked about the bogging down of that bill with the dash two amendments.
Mm-hmm.
And, with the dash two amendments, they would move to the floor within 24 hours.
I understand that. I think the issue is we're concerned about a concurrence vote. We received strong signals from the House side that they were concerned about us messing with this either way.
Well, thank you.
Jeez, there's a lot of Republicans on this bill.
Yes, there are, Senator Courtney. Your observation is duly noted. So the chair is going to move House Bill 2729 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion.
Can we have a vote on the dash twos?
Sure.
Can I move the dash twos?
Senator Atkinson has moved the dash. I think they're the dash ones, though, Senator Atkinson.
That's what I meant to say.
Okay.
I think they're the dash twos.
Dash twos,
yeah.
All right. Senator Atkinson.
You guys are always trying to mess me up.
I just gave you the amendments to make the move.
Senator Farioli told me that they were dash ones. I was just listening to Senator Farioli. Senator Atkinson has moved. The chair withdraws her motion to move 2729 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Atkinson has moved the dash two amendments to House Bill 2729. Would you please call the roll?
Yes.
No.
Vice Chair Farioli? Aye.
Chair votes no.
No.
Motion fails. Chair would move House Bill 2729 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Yes.
Aye.
No.
Chair
Brown?
Chair votes aye.
Yes.
Motion carries.
Now you gotta take one.
Senator Westland will carry this bill. All right. Anyone knows 1051? Are you guys okay with it? What about 1076?
You can do the Pomperazzi bill?
Yeah, do it. Oh, there's
okay.
One.
Okay.
That must be the best
thing.
Okay. All right. Oh, yes. Okay. All right. So you guys are okay with both 1051 and 1076. Senator Courtney, I believe your services are no longer needed, unless you wish to stay.
Oh, we need them. We need them.
Okay.
It might get dicey.
All right. 2596.
Come on, let's go.
All right. Waiting for amendments. Okay. I'm not going to move into work session on 2596. Understand we're waiting for amendments.
Actually, 3093. We have two plumbers.
Wait, no. I'm back up at the top of the list. 2596.
Right. That bill actually doesn't have amendments.
Okay.
It's the other plumbing bill.
Got it. Okay.
Has amendments that aren't finished.
I'm going to listen to staff.
And that is
okay.
House Bill 39.
All right. So I'm going to open a work session on 2596. No amendments. Right. The chair would move House Bill 2956. Thank you. 2596 to the Senate floor of the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. Who would like to carry this bill?
We wouldn't want it to get out.
Senator Shields, we appreciate your willingness to volunteer.
That's a thriller.
But we'll flush this bill.
All right. Chair would open the work session on 2831. There are no amendments to that bill, as I recall.
Correct, Madam Chair.
Chair would move House Bill 2831 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Farriola, would be great if you would carry that bill. Let's see. 3050? Okay. Amendments? Okay. Chair would open a work session on House Bill 3050. There are no amendments to the bill. The chair would move the House Bill 3050 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? And hearing and seeing none? So ordered. 3083, do we have amendments? No. Okay. All right. Chair would open. We're waiting for amendments.
3178 is the next one.
There's a dash one.
Yes, there are amendments, but they're ready.
But they're ready.
Okay. All right. Let's open a work session on House Bill 3179. The professor, as you might recall, walked us through the dash one amendments. The chair would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3179. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none? So ordered. The chair would move House Bill 3179 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended.
As amended, thank you. Discussion? Objection? None. So ordered.
It's a Courtney bill, isn't it?
I probably.
It is now.
All right, let's give it to him. Okay. Are the amendments ready on Senate Bill 1051?
Yes, we have the dash ones before us, Madam Chair.
Okay, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1051. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the amendments, if you can find them?
Sure.
And then we'll do 1076.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senate Bill 1050, or the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1051 replace the original measure and make physicians agents of the Department of Human Services when those physicians are treating patients as part of the Oregon Health Plan.
All right. We're in work session. The chair would move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1051. Discussion? Senator Shields.
15, 20 minutes ago, there were people in front of us that said that they hadn't seen those amendments and wanted to comment on them when they were out. I don't know that any of them are here. Is there any? I'd just ask. Are any of those people still here and want to comment?
I'm not about to scream. Anybody wishing to testify on the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1050?
Scream.
That's my favorite part, but.
I can't remember who they were.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate that. No, it's really important.
I heard her yelling.
That was pretty good.
She did.
Beaver still. Is this Beaver still
screaming?
Okay. No. Any further discussion on Senate Bill 1051-1 amendments? Any objection to the amendments? Hearing seeing none, so ordered. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. All right, let's open a work session on Senate Bill 1076. We have amendments from Senator Devlin.
Yes, we have dash ones that were delivered to us today during the hearing.
All right. The dash one amendments are in front of us. Pretty straightforward. Senator Devlin just testified on them. Any discussion about the Dash 1 amendments? Chair would move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1076. Any objection? So order. Chair would move Senate Bill 1076. We have a Ways and Means referral on that one. Are we okay?
Not really.
Excellent question.
Did you give the gut and stuff we did for Westland to Ben to carry?
I can do that. Yeah. I didn't give it to anyone.
Well, there you go.
Okay. No amendment. Oh.
I'm looking for the Ways and Means
referral. Okay. All right. Let's be at ease for a minute. I did not approve. We're back on the record and work session on Senate Bill 1076. The chair has moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1076, which were adopted. The chair would move Senate Bill 1076 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Any discussion? Any objection? Thank you very much. Two bills we did not move. House Bill
39-3.
Yes. I'm going to move up to work session on House Bill 2976. There were the dash. You had amendments on that bill. No, there were amendments.
Okay.
I remember. I thought they walked us through some amendments. Will you check on that one?
Yeah, I might have no amendments.
Okay, maybe it's just I'm on drugs. Oh, they made the amendments on the House side. Okay. All right.
Say that on the record.
Chocolate. All right. We're in work session on House Bill 2976. What is the committee's pleasure? Okay. Senator Farioli has moved House Bill 2976 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. I'll go ahead and carry that. That'll be good practice for my former family law skills. 3083. We're holding for amendments. I'm not going to be sure.
And the fire chiefs, or the
paparazzi bill?
Paparazzi.
Protective Association folks were going to go in the hallway and see if they could look at language from the, which they were bringing to show.
On 3093.
Yeah, okay. Bringing it back.
Anything further to come before the committee?
Yeah.
All right. We're going to be same thing tomorrow in terms of we'll just work through. We have a fairly hefty schedule on some of the bills that we did not hear today. Will be heard tomorrow. Senator Brown will carry 2772, and Senator Devlin will carry 1076. All right. Any further business to come before the committee? We're adjourned. Thank you very much, you guys. Good work.